Hi everybody, we're back. I am Jonathan Stern, but most of you know that. What is that dinging?
It's you when you're clock.
And how does it relate to the frequency of quartz? I'm sorry, we covered that this morning. It is my pleasure. So we're going to do the last session. As many of you know, Georgina Bourne was unable to join us. So we're going to do things a little differently. And in a way, it's going to work out really well. Natalie's going to speak for a few minutes to introduce her piece, and then we're going to watch a video she made. Then we're going to move straight to a discussion. And then at the end of that session, we're going to move straight to a final session that's going to be very... I hesitate to use this word, interactive, but there you go. So it's my pleasure and privilege to introduce to you Natalie Bookchin. She's been on the Faculty of Photography and Media Program at in the Art School at CalArts since 1998. She's currently on leave from CalArts, living in Brooklyn and teaching media art at the Mason Gross School of Arts at Rutgers University. Now, Natalie's been doing net art since the 1990s. She was a member of Artmark, a collective that some of you might recall, and... some of her recent work has been making its way around the academic scene, My Meds, Laid Off, Mass Ornament. If you haven't seen these, I highly recommend them. And I'll just tell you, I was at a conference mostly made up of English professors in September, and my colleague Wendy Chun put up a Natalie Bookchin video, and the whole room was like, oh my God, you can do that? Well, I told her. It was really cool. Maybe you won't be surprised, but I hope you're at least as delighted as I am. And so I give you Natalie Bookchin.
So I echo all of the previous thanks that everyone has given to everybody. Wholeheartedly, and especially to the students for being here on a Saturday afternoon and for being so engaged. It's really very heartening and fantastic to see that. So I'm going to say very little, but I want to set up what I'm going to be showing you and also qualify it a little bit. And then I'm going to be showing you a project that I have been working on for 2 years that... Last week, I've been working on little sections of it, and last week I kind of put it together. And this is probably not the final way that it's being put together, but, and I'm not sure about the end, and there's a lot of timing stuff that I still need to work out. But you are last week I tested it in Istanbul, and you are my second test audience. So I will be feeling the affect. Whether or not you respond as I screen it. So the project is called Long Story Short, and in its final version, it will exist on three platforms independently. One of them will be a single channel video that will, right now it's 33 minutes. It'll be more or less that. You may tell me it's way too long, or like there's certain things missing, or you may not tell me any of that. But it'll be sort of around 30 minutes. And then it's also going to be a 9-channel installation, and that will surround viewers probably in a kind of a gallery-like space. And it will also exist online for anyone to watch, and it will be attached to an archive and that I'll talk about in a second. So... The project consists, first of all, and it's different than my previous work, in fact, in some ways the polar opposite, in that I first built my own archive by going out into the world and talking to people and finding people to participate. And then I made a film that tries to animate that archive or perform the archive. And it takes form as a composite group interview, sort of similar to previous work in that I'm assembling the interview, in this case, from numerous fragments from the archive. So to create the archive, and this is information that you'll get when you watch the film, the final version, but you don't get right now, for about a year in 2014 during the Great Recession. I presented my ideas for the project in a number of nonprofit organizations in Northern and Southern California that people go to receive services like shelter and food, educational support, and job training. And I presented the work to people, and I invited anyone who wanted to participate, which involved making a video diary, looking at a webcam, sitting in front of a laptop, and addressing, specifically, I asked people to address directly the middle class and wealthy people, and to tell us what they thought that we needed to know, what we didn't get about the challenges of living in poverty and the realities of living in poverty, and what they thought that they and we needed to do to kind of solve the problem of poverty in America. And so people that participated made hour-long videos, mostly hour-long, sometimes longer, sometimes shorter videos in spare rooms that we found in the nonprofits where they narrate their responses. I gave them a list of not questions but prompts, and they were invited to think about them, respond to them, reject them, change them, but just as a way to try to sort of give people many of whom had never made videos before, you know, some kind of framework to narrate what they chose to narrate. And my intention in doing this was to try to create an archive that didn't exist online using the kinds of using the form and the aesthetic of amateur online video that was so pervasive, to create a collective portrait of a class of people inaudible and invisible in the media, online and offline, composed not of people, not of the overused image of people on the streets, but people presenting themselves as they want to be presenting and sharing information and expert knowledge that they have that they want to present. So in some ways, it was a kind of trying to present a counter-narrative of how people in poverty in the United States are represented, which is often in the way I've just described, or in human interest documentaries where you have one or a few charismatic individuals who overcome their obstacles. So the focus is often on the individual, and I wanted to instead try to shift it from an individual to more of a kind of, to look at it more as a something where the issues or questions or sort of even the way that people narrate their stories, there's something perhaps shared. That's what I was kind of curious about, was were there shared stories or shared language that people used or didn't use or avoided. And so in the form and the style of the work, as I mentioned, I locate it within the vernacular of social media, partly to kind of sort of address what's missing, but also to make a link between the rise in digital network technology with the drastic increase in poverty, and to use the same technologies that have displaced so many people who have, you know, sort of unskilled labor, to use the same tools to amplify or to sort of give people the opportunity to amplify their voices. And it also borrows from social media in the shift away from single voice to many voices, and also to the expansion of who gets to speak in public and what we consider expert knowledge, which, you know, sort of like we're all experts on about restaurants, right, on Yelp, or, you know, so but we're not all necessarily heard as experts on the question of class or money. So the videos you'll see have all the markings of amateur online video. Faces are lit by the screen. It's both like very intimate in the direct address and also mediated, right, through the screen. So, and the montage, I just will say a word about sort of the highly edited montage that I present from the archive is intentionally not seamless, in that you will see very sort of very clearly my hand as an editor, which, you know, sort of in trying to kind of draw out certain kinds of what I saw as patterns or repeated words or repeated stories. And so it is, you know, sort of fundamentally a collaboration in that way that, you know, sort of people have the stories that they chose to tell. They omit certain things and they included certain things. And then I also, in this form that you're going to see tonight, I'm also, you know, sort of clearly editing and leaving out and fabricating and presenting something that is part fiction and part fact. But, I'm trying to draw out in the material a social voice or to organize the language in a way that, in some ways, I mean, there is a question of, you know, sort of is authenticity versus artificiality that maybe we can talk about later. Like, what is more authentic? Is a single narration uncut more authentic than an edited one? I use musicality and rhythm, and you'll see there's kind of small ensembles, duets, big choral movements, and there's this move between an individual voice and a collective voice. In the online version, you'll have the opportunity as somebody who's viewing the film to hear anybody's story in full that you don't get to hear in the video that I'm showing you tonight or today. And it's my hope that it'll be reorganized and reordered and distributed so that people's stories will be distributed in a space where they're right now non-existent for the most part. So it's very jumpy. It will be jumpy when it's completed, but not quite as jumpy. And I'm not going to say any more. So if we could get the lights.
You never know, like, really what somebody's going through by looking at them until you ask them. And then they might not even tell you.
They may not let you know, or they may not tell you.
And they might not tell you all of it.
But I guarantee every person is here or going through this situation. There's a lot of anger and a lot of hurt.
You know, but you really never know what people are going through. You never know.
My name is Melinda Emelian. I don't know, my mind went blank. Oh my gosh. Gosh, maybe I should write this down.
That's okay, you can take your time.
Okay, my interests are... I love to read. I love knowledge. I love computers. And I like being a mom. I like doing the mom thing. Let's see, what else? Only thing I really like doing is reading. It takes me out of my situation, you know, it takes me into it takes me out of my situation that I'm in now. But even when I'm not in a situation, I still like to read, but I really like to read now more than ever. I like Facebook. It also takes me out of the situation because you can be anybody you want to be on a computer. It could be anybody. Not that I want to be somebody different, but, oh, I sound like I'm contradicting myself. Oh, I don't want to see this when it's done. I'm sorry. I like TV too. I like reality shows. But reality shows is reality. You know, you can't, you know. I mean, not that they're really reality because they're all edited and stuff, but, you know, what's happening is live, you know, it's them. But in a book, you know, you can create your own ending, you can create your own beginning, you know, even though it's someone else's story that they're telling. And I like that. what does the general public need to know about living with limited resources?
The general public.
That's a big question, yeah.
I'm going to pass on that one.
Okay. I was saying they need to know that it's one of the hardest things you can do.
I believe that those people with all that money,
people that that are middle class, or
people that have,
or higher class,
we'll take it for granted.
I think it's really hard for people to.
People just
probably
don't understand how it feels, how it is to be poor. It affects us mentally, emotionally, and even physically.
They don't probably understand.
You don't know
how
what
it
is
to really struggle financially.
Everyone has their situations.
Everybody has issues.
Everyone has struggles.
And everybody has problems.
Trying to make ends meet.
But
problems that they face.
Financial issues and poverty issues are
not the same.
You know, it's just the rules
are different because
so if you ain't got money, you ain't got nothing. We're not playing on the same playing field, you know.
If you don't have money.
You know, everything in this country is...
We're in a country...
We live in a capitalistic society...
That requires for
you
us
have
to
have
money
here.
You need money to do basic things, just to live.
Money is kind of like the new form of slavery in America.
More than race.
And power is money here.
If you got the money, I can overlook your color or your something or your...
That's the only way you can change things here.
You know what I mean?
You need money to just keep yourself up, not even just keeping up with the Joneses. You need money just to feel like a normal citizen.
Because I don't have money, I just know I can't participate in life and do the kind of things
that you regularly do every day,
quote unquote, your average person does.
You need money just to feel like you're human.
I don't want to use the word poverty. It just sounds like such a... Well, we know what we think of when we hear the word poverty.
The way I felt when I didn't have any money and I was still young, it felt as if I was a rock. And I was kicked around every day by different people who had nice shoes on. I could just remember having no hope, being hopeless.
So I count to three now.
Yeah.
Hello, my name is Tito McMillan. I'm 40 years old, and my interests in that I have are playing with my children. I just I have three grandchildren. I enjoy playing with them. PlayStation, Madden 13. That's my hobbies. I worked pretty much all my life up until 2011. And I drove for AAA for 15 years. And I enjoyed it. You know, it was anywhere from 14 hours a day. Because you at least want to make it. You know, at least $100, and it's kind of hard doing that when you got 25 other drivers out there, and you might have 19 calls in a day. That part of it messed it up for me. I in 2010 I quit to go out to Texas. They have refining jobs at the oil rigs out there, pretty good money. But once I got out there, it was something totally different. And if I could, I would enjoy it. Would love to get back into a tow truck.
It's like you come to a fork in the road when you're poor and you're living in poverty, and it's like it feels you're backed into a corner when you don't have any
money
to like get
hygiene
stuff,
necessities
to wash your clothes, to go to laundry.
You don't have
shampoo.
You don't have money for
toothbrush, toothpaste,
and all those different things.
And all that other stuff.
I'm getting paid minimum wage.
Like, we can't even afford to keep
a roof over our head.
And then what do you do?
I mean, how does that work? That's my roadblock of trying to find a job.
And I don't want to sound like I'm complaining, but I just want to be very real about the situation. And the situation is hard because
I want to work.
But I like to work. I want to get up and
I want to go to work. It feels good.
I don't want to just sit around.
It feels good doing something with your life, doing something productive.
I mean, I would love to, but
when you don't have that cell phone.
Man, I ain't got no phone.
You have no phone.
Where they can contact you.
If they want you to come in for an interview, how are they going to call you?
You don't have
I ain't
that
got no address.
What kind of address am I going to put on an application for a job?
I ain't had a shower.
You know, but half my day is gone.
There's the lunch.
Trying to take a shower. And trying to eat. And then the rest of the day is pretty much done.
What I look like going on an interview like that?
I'm coming in an interview, leaving from a Walmart bathroom, freshening up, and sleeping in my car at night.
The mailman is not going to deliver any mail saying I got an interview tomorrow to my car or to the tree that I'm sleeping under.
By the time the job interview comes along, it just seems like you're so exhausted to go actually on it.
Because you're not in a comfortable state. So when you're not comfortable, I believe that people can see it.
It's hard.
You know, you just don't seem like you have the energy
to try to keep some
kind
of
positive person
attitude
that you need to be.
It's very, very difficult
on a job interview.
People can kind of feel it in your when you talk and how you speak and I don't know, but I couldn't find a job, and I didn't find a job for 4 years.
It just wasn't coming, and I found out that. You know, I wasn't the only one in that condition, in that position, that there was just work for no one. And that was the sign of the times that when that all started, 2009, 2010, 11, you know.
Trying to survive with just food stamps,
which is only $15 a month.
It's just not enough.
It's a joke.
To live in hell. Just to be honest.
I call it the American nightmare.
I run out of food stamps.
I always run out of money.
Maybe 10 days.
About halfway through the month.
Before the end of the month.
Every month. It's a given.
Regardless of how you spend them.
So in those 10 days,
I look for
they have to find places where they feed us, you know. Sometimes there's not even a place to go.
You know, you're hungry. Your kid is hungry.
Being hungry.
I have been hungry.
Numerous of days.
For days.
Not having the funds.
Oh, just trying to make sure that my
to get my kids
family ate.
Something to eat.
Okay, my name is Billy Counts. Right now, I'm currently living in a homeless shelter, I guess. It's a pretty nice place, too. After 18 years in prison, I'm restarting my life all over again. So I'm going to try to make the best out of life that I have left. 2 weeks ago, I completed an associate's degree in biblical studies. These opportunities has given me hope, you know, what I didn't previously have when I came out of prison. The Board of Prison Terms asked me a question, and that was, how do I feel about getting let out of prison? And I told them, I'm scared to death. But if they open the door, I'm going. And they opened the door.
A lot of people I know, including myself, is like...
I had always taken pride in doing all of it by myself.
It's hard to ask for help.
I can't ask people for stuff.
There are people that don't want any help.
It's like they're too proud to beg.
They do, but they're too ashamed.
They don't I can't ask people for money. I can't beg people for money. I don't do that.
They don't want to Say, can I borrow some money?
I'm not the type of person that could stand on the side of the freeway, you know, put my hand out and ask for help.
Well, I went and stood on a corner. And I tried to hold up the sign, and I couldn't. My body wouldn't let me.
If I don't have it, then I just kind of do without.
Can you talk about where you're from? Describe the neighborhood you grew up in and where you live right now.
I grew up in a small town in Arkansas called England, Arkansas, population 3,060 people. There was a set of railroad tracks that ran through the middle of the town, whites on one side, blacks on the other.
I grew up on the wrong side of the street.
On my side of the street were ran down apartments, and then on the opposite side of the street were upscale condos.
The whites owned all the property and the farms, and the blacks worked on the farms.
But out here in California,
I seen only black people.
I didn't grow up with many white people around.
It was pretty much just us.
Hispanics, Latinos.
A lot of African-Americans.
And Mexicans.
Lived on the flatlands.
It's not like in a very good neighborhood.
Not the good areas of L.A.
And then predominantly middle class.
Rich people. People who have good money. Live in the hills, you know. They don't want to be where the urban people are, you know. They don't want to be where all the poverty is and all the people who are homeless.
It's not, you know, I mean, a coincidence. This is done all over the United States.
We were, like, pretty much secluded from the regular city, you know.
And they have it all cornered in and contained right there around the police station.
The air even smells different for some reason.
And the police is patrolling to make sure that we don't bother the nice neighborhood.
To me, we more like a bunch of crabs in a bucket, and we pull each other down.
I'll make this more clear. There's not a lot in the neighborhood.
It's nothing positive out here.
There's so many people out of jobs there, out in the street looking for jobs.
I wouldn't never see seen in the suburbs of white neighborhoods.
African American men.
The white guys
hanging out on a corner.
Hanging out at the liquor store.
In Compton is
okay,
in my neighborhood, within a two-block radius, you have six liquor stores.
We have
it's like a liquor store on every corner. You know,
do the math.
Okay. My name is DeRay. I'm 25. I have a daughter who's 4, and I currently live at Euclid Villa, which is a homeless shelter. I have cerebral palsy, and I'm a very strong person, very outgoing, very motivated, very funny, bubbly person, and that's me. I live in Los Angeles. I don't care to give that out. And this city is full of pretty much millionaires. You know what's funny? Half this city is like rich, and the other side is poor. And then it's like, you know, oh my God, you live in this place where there's billionaires like right down the street from you. And yet you're struggling just to get insurance and struggling to pay this. And there's a billionaire right down the street. Yeah, it's so funny. But it's true. And everybody's like, the city of angels, oh, I can't wait to go to Los Angeles. But if they could see that there is a whole other side that is so poor, like in poverty. Like really bad, like little hut houses. I don't know why that is. Maybe they, I don't know, but I've seen it. And then you go to this beautiful side of, can I say this? Hollywood, and it's like gorgeous. Make you want to cry. The side, my bathroom, their bathroom is bigger than my house. And it's like, holy crap. How do you get there?
When we lived in Inglewood, I mean, now when I go back to L.A., it's horrible, but I don't know.
My name
when I was growing up, it was really nice.
It was a lot of fun. In actuality, it was a lot of fun.
It was a very residential
neighborhood with all houses.
I knew most of the people on my street and the neighboring streets.
It was just like, we were just real tight. It was like in the whole neighborhood.
Your own neighborhood.
Family.
Your own family. And everybody knows each other, know what's going in, what's going out.
Neighbors help take care of each other. Or look out for each other. and try to help each other as much as they can.
You know, as a kid, we ran around the city a lot, around our neighborhood.
We used to stay out late, played outside, like, you know, summertime.
We would go swimming.
We would fight, garden.
We played sports, you
climb
know,
trees
like
and
football.
We used to play with Barbie dolls. And
fire hydrants being busted
and
open.
Some of the vacant fields.
It was
a lot of fun things
had
to do.
Some really good games there.
As a child, growing up in West Oakland.
Then I moved away from Carson and went to Englewood, and it was like a different world.
I think when things started going down south in the LA area around the 90s is when my parents decided to move out to Palmdale.
And then we kind of moved on up from there. We moved away from the projects
into middle class
neighborhood. I lived on the east side. It was better.
It was beautiful.
It was quite comfortable.
I lived in the suburbs in our own home, and I grew up with
a nice four-bedroom house, big house
in West Oakland.
We were very middle class. We were one of the first tracts in Orange County.
I didn't want and need for anything. If I had to say, me and my brother were pretty spoiled.
In 2008, my mom's house foreclosed due to a loan scam. There was a lot of fraud things going on, so she thought that she would be able to trust whoever the broker was to reevaluate her loan and give her a lower mortgage on her house. And somehow the lady transferred the house over to someone else's name and kind of quick sold it over, quick loan, quick deed, quick something over to her name, sold the house from underneath my mom, and within like 3 weeks we had to get out of there. And that is where me and both my brothers and my sister, we all were there.
My experience in not having money.
When people have too little money,
it caused people
to
do
things that you would never think
that they
would have to
normally do.
As far as degrading your own self.
You just have to, you know, do things that you never thought you would do. Things that you never thought that you would do. You have to do so that your kids could go to school every day. And not be hungry, and be okay. You know? Things like, for an example,
being hungry and having to panhandle and ask people.
I've had to ask people
to get food. I've had to do that a couple of times.
For help.
For money. For food.
I never thought that I would have to panic.
And it's really degrading.
But I need to feed my children.
It's not good.
To put gas in the car, to get them to school.
It's just embarrassing.
To buy them shoes.
It definitely took a toll on my ego. And that in turn kind of made me give up on myself as far as getting off the street. Didn't like the way I was living. Or live, but sometimes it just feels like there's no way out. And a lot of times there isn't.
You know, things are not okay. Certain things that the media needs to say, they're not saying. There's people out here that are struggling and they're doing the right thing. There's people out here that are homeless and they're trying to go to school, but they can't. And it needs to be known. And, you know, I just want the media to stop telling lies to our communities.
People call people that don't have a lot of money or not that much money, people call them
worthless, bums,
non-entities.
You're at the bottom of the barrel.
The lowest of the low.
You don't reach the gutter now.
But you don't count.
Not having enough money and being poor makes you feel just like you're trash.
I don't know if anybody's ever looked at me and just said, you're poor, and so you're a loser. Although I'm sure there are people that have thought that.
You've thought it.
The reason why I wanted to even do this with you guys is because hopefully this will get to someone that we need some type of living wage in California. I mean, the fact that you need two full-time incomes just to pay the rent. That's not even talking about eating or maintaining a vehicle or paying gas or paying lights. It does not make sense. So I don't know if we can maybe collectively figure out how we can do that in this country. I think it would help a lot of people.
The neighborhood that we lived in was,
I basically grew up in
pretty much.
I grew up in a gang-related,
drug-infested environment.
There was a lot of gangs everywhere.
Nothing but gangs.
Gang members out there on the streets, and still gang members to this day there.
Where everything around you is either graffiti, drugs, or violence.
I live around a lot of drugs.
There's a lot of drug activity in the streets.
I mean, a lot of drugs outside my home.
A lot of criminal activity going on.
There are people hanging around the park.
Pimps, players,
yeah,
drug selling.
Selling drugs.
Drug dealers on the corner.
Shooting one another.
Major prostitution.
Hustlers.
Drug addicts.
People smoking crack. Heroin, just sleeping outside, just the whole deal.
I live on a lot of violence.
Constant violence.
A lot of violence in my community. It's really been kind of rough with the gang violence and murders going on here.
We got a lot of shooting in the area.
You hear a lot of
gunshots. We got drive-by shootings.
There's homicides and killings and drugs every day.
A lot of people are getting hurt.
I even see somebody
robbing them when they coming home from work.
You see people just, you know, run across your yard and they get shot and you just see them fall down and die.
It's not safe. And I'm scared to go home.
Having to worry about looking over their shoulder.
I have to look over my shoulder.
Sometimes walking in the house.
Make sure there's no one behind me.
Never know.
Trying to rob me or kill me.
We're killing each other here in this place.
You know, kill to be killed.
Or be killed trying to survive.
I'm going to put it to you like this in this perspective. I was born in chains because of my social institution. And I've seen this all my life, so I thought it was normal growing up. And I call American Ghetto a prison. And I even call it Baby Iraq because in our communities, we got little kids running around with AK-47 and AR-15, killing each other. But, you know, I really believe that them are tears that's coming out of them barrels. Them are tears of neglection.
My name is Leanne Clark. I'm 36 years old. My interests... film and criminal justice, which I know is a weird combination, but that's what I like. I have two BAs, one in criminal justice, one in theater. I have two AAs, one in social work, one in liberal arts. And eventually I want to get my PhD in criminal justice. This time around, I became homeless on July 7th of 2012. I have yet to make it to middle class, but one day maybe.
For those watching this film who have the most political power, what do you think they need to know? And what would you like to say to them?
For the political people watching this,
what I will say to the people out there is this.
Come down here and live in West Oakland and see what it's like.
Take a walk through communities like Oakland.
It's not all bad, but, you know.
Come to the neighborhood.
Just come down this way to see.
Come down here and
come to the poorest of poor neighborhood.
Would you guys consider the ghetto?
The pizza man won't come in our neighborhood.
You know, you call it the ghetto, the hood, the slums, the gutter, the peasant hood, whatever you want.
Come down here and spend some time.
If
you know, everybody
these people
saying
who
they're
say
doing
they are
for
the people, were actually more in touch with the people
and aware of what's going on in your community
and the realities of what some of us are actually going through here.
If you're really doing it for the people, come down here and hang out with the people.
I just wish there was more people that would just talk to us.
Talk to me.
Talk to them.
I can let you know.
Talk to some of us that actually know what the system is and where the flaws are at.
See what their needs are.
Hear what's out and try to understand our
point my point of view. Or a point of view of a sister.
As far as the reason why I'm not really into politics, I don't really think that anybody would really listen to me. You know, they're too busy wanting to take care of other countries. I know they're our allies and we got to trade or whatever, but take care of home first. You know, you take care of the starving children you have here and, you know, better education. And if you want to go to college, don't make it so expensive. I think you would eliminate half the problems that's going on right now. Because a person, if you can't have it, a person's not going to want it. So even from my experience, you know, here I am needing a job, needing some bus fare to go to an application, and nobody will help me.
Helping the community is like, first we got to get acknowledged. I mean, come on, you know. Obama's just worried about the middle class and the upper class, and lower class don't exist. And as long as we don't exist, it's just going to continue to be the way it is.
Come down here. I stress that more than anything. Just come down here. You think, you know, I think I can go live in your neighborhood as well. You know, I can survive in your neighborhood. You think you can come to mine and smile and as you say, stay civilized in society and not lose your cool. Come on. You walk outside your door and you hear gunshots. Just the other day, I don't know how fast they were going down my street. Police chasing a Pontiac. My daughter just came across the street. I mean, they had to be doing at least 60 miles an hour down the street with the police chasing them. Come on. I give you a day. You can come stay at my house.
I would love for someone in political power who's watching this to imagine being in this chair where I'm sitting right now. Imagine you have been let go from your job. You have lost your car, your family, and your house. And imagine how you would exist, and would you survive? And without the government, without private funding, the answer for me is no.
That's pretty much what I would say to you all. If you know you really want to help
us, not hinder
you know,
us,
leave those executive offices.
You guys in the office,
in the position of power,
are getting selfish. That's why we're falling apart out in the street.
Why don't you help them be where you're at?
If people with power
people should took their time to come out here and
walk around and try to recognize some of the challenges that people are facing.
And why they got there, why are they still there.
I think that would just make someone's day. It really would.
And that's a privilege to be able to help somebody else. It makes you feel good. That choice starts with you.
And if we would all work together.
Everybody come together and stick together.
We're all in this together.
We have to deal with it together.
We can do it together.
A lot of things could change.
And maybe there can be a change. That's how I feel.
When Occupy came to Oakland, I went downtown Broadway. And I'm not bragging, but I'm telling you, I went down there and I say, Occupy, before you came, these young black people were hanging out downtown looking for a safe place to be without being harassed by the police. They were here. You know, I asked Occupy to go to East Oakland and show some interest in these neighborhoods. That's like, you know, don't just go make it a nice environment for you and explain to the people this is our neighborhood. Don't go gentrifying. Say this is our neighborhood. We're a part of this. Let's make this beautiful together.
Every story has a different side. So if you're just outside of this box of smoke, you can't say, oh, we'll turn the fan on from the north and it'll blow it all out. You've actually got to get in there with the smoke and see what's causing this smoke.
Okay. My name's Christina. I'm 22. I have two boys. Right now, I'm just trying to get my GED. I have two tests to finish, and after that, I want to maybe go to a community college and study in nursing or childcare.
Medical field.
Sometimes I just want to give up, but I can't.
I gotta think about my children.
Two kids that are looking up at me. So
I don't want them to grow up like I did.
Yeah.
All right, we've got some time for questions. We will start with Patrick and or Eric. When they get a mic. There's stairs.
Okay. Considering the more direct hand you have in the construction of these social voices, like setting up the studio, your agency as an editor, as well as performing the recording sessions as interviews rather than individual video blogs, can you speak more directly about your navigation of ideas surrounding authenticity and authority? And also how the messages of your participants have changed in contrast with your previous work?
The major difference between this work and the previous work, as you're suggesting, is that my hand in their response is much greater, right? In the previous work, I was making videos based on material that I found online. So I had no relationship to what people were saying. I was only looking at the result, trying to shape something out of the results. But I'm in the questions. So my editing is sort of, only one part of how I'm shaping. It's much more of a conversation, right, between me and the people who decided to participate with me. Mm-hmm. So that's one part of it. And the other question was?
Oh, that was, like, the notion between, like, the, authority, like, your role, or how your authority is manifest within this versus, like, the authenticity of their responses within this construct.
You know, I'd be much more interested to hear what you thought of that, in a way. You know, I mean, I think I'm trying to make my hand very visible. So, I mean, all film is manipulation, you know, but I'm trying to make my manipulation quite present within it. And so I actually think that what I'm also trying to do is listen very carefully to what lots of people are saying, and in an unscientific way, but borrowing from sociology or borrowing from the digital humanities, but using a, you know, sort of filtering it through me rather than through an algorithm, I'm trying to, you know, sort of look at the body of responses and make links that were, that may be present in the individual speakers. But then at the same time, I'm also making my, you know, those choices very visible. Like, you can see that I've put it together, right? So so in some ways, I mean, I have the authority, but I'm also trying to make that authority visible. Like, I'm trying to show the man behind the curtain, who's not a man in this case, but, you know, so I don't know if that at least tries to address the question.
I would say so. Yeah, thank you very much. And thank you for bringing this evocative work to us here today. It was a real pleasure to be able to see this, even as a work in progress. So thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. I mean, I found this very impressive. For me, it's a sort of a new kind of sociology and or oral history, and it's also a composition for me because this rhythm, it has such a rhythm that the rhythm itself makes that you keep listening, even apart from the messages that are important enough. So I think the form and the message is really impressive. But there's one thing I would like to ask to all of you, and that's perhaps because I am from Europe. I'm getting
sorry. I don't know why I'm getting so emotional, but I have the feeling that I've been at a conference with very rich people, and that you're talking about politics all the time. You're not doing it. And it's not, of course, you make a very political, I mean, this is not about you. You're making something that is very political. But at the same time, I have the feeling, him of you is part of a political party, is involved in politics. You're also critical. It's all about being critical. But what are you doing? And I don't understand why I'm so emotional now, but perhaps because I've been in poverty myself, but it's not the reason. It is that something in Canada and the United States is, there is such a difference between university life and the rest of life, which I do not recognize from my life in the Netherlands. We take much more responsibility, to be honest, in distributing wealth, in creating insurance. We don't have beggars on the streets. There is poverty, but the system is completely different. And I don't know why you keep talking, but why don't you change the system? Why are intellectuals not really involved in the political system? This is what I experienced for so many years when I'm in the States and in Canada. Sorry for being so emotional about this, but I think it's the heart of the matter. You are outside society. That's how I feel it. And actually, I feel sometimes so uncomfortable when I'm at conference in the United States, exactly for this reason. So I really hope that you say something about this. Sorry.
Do you want me to respond? Should I?
Yeah. I think this is excellent work, but it also shows what you need to do as intellectuals. I think you step out of even out of this cozy world of conferences, right?
I think it's much bigger than the conferences. I mean, it's like when I was for years doing work with online videos, and I was hearing certain kind of stories, and I wasn't hearing other kind of stories. So I don't think what I'm doing is, it's not direct action, it's not activism, it's making images.
Yeah.
And but I think that somehow, like, sort of to make visible or to put those into digital circulation, sort of is some way of at least making present something that for so many people isn't even in the sort of range of what they see or hear. And so I think there's different ways that people are involved in it. I mean, I agree with you, and it's really shocking to be a European and come to North America. It's really shocking.
It is.
Yeah. Can I add something? But I don't think it's going. I appreciate it very much, the response. But I think we're at a point where I disagree about the European-America divide now in that sort of sense, because even I'm in Germany at the moment, and if you're in the former East Germany and you have a job, 60% of those people have no contract, with no fixed contract. If you're in the former West Germany, the people working, almost 50% have no fixed contract. Of the people in Germany working full-time, 27% of them actually can't afford to feed themselves. In Ireland, 25% of children are in structural poverty. The UK isn't far behind in that. There is, I think, almost 60% youth unemployment in Spain. It's not far behind that in Greece. So I think there's definitely, I think what I'm trying to get is that the social contract in some of it that's been hammered, that was sort of so established after the war, is under dreadful attack, so I think I think there's an element too, even within Europe, and that was reflected even in the recent elections. So that there's a convergence that's happening a structural conversion. No, but even in the Netherlands, there was, you know, the National Party in the last election were 10% of the popular vote. So I wonder about that convergence.
Yeah, the real problem, in my view, is that intellectuals are not part of politics anymore. I mean, if you also in the Netherlands, I mean, it's getting worse. In the local councils, the people that represent us are not, you know, their education is sort of declining. So you get a sort of the gap is between. Yeah, I feel increasingly guilty. You are in these universities, we have terrific jobs, we can travel, but I mean, I'm also talking to myself. I mean, but of course the situation in the Netherlands, you cannot compare it with the United States. I mean, even though, of course, people have temporary contracts, but that's not the same as having absolutely no possibility of, you know.
Can I ask a question and intervene in this a little bit? I don't know if I'm going to make any sense, because I started by wanting to say something about ethnography, because this is ethnography. This is not sociology to me. And the question of authenticity, I think this is all going to come back to what you're talking about. Why are we still using that word? I mean, really? Like, what does that mean, authenticity? All we can do as Americans, and I have to say I've lived in Europe, so I know what you're talking about. There is no question that there's more of a social network in Europe. There's no question about it. You know, no matter how it's being chipped away, it's a different system. Americans live in a country with 300 million plus people, and we have internalize late capitalism to the point where mainly our goals in life have to do with lifestyle. And that's what we've acceded to as academics and as artists. And, you know, we try not to do that all the time. We try to create incredibly important messages, even if they don't seem to be explicitly political. And I would argue that, in fact, you know, your work is incredibly important precisely because it disallows that kind of lazy acceding to lifestyle, even if just for the moment that somebody has to be listening to other people. And I think the most useful way to think about how that's working is through critical ethnography, you know, which of course it's always going to be conditioned by your constructive techniques, by your interviewing, by the, you know, the very studio that they're sitting in, by the fact that it's even taped on video. I mean, all of those things, that's just what it is. So there's no point in trying to be authentic, because I don't even know what that means. I mean, what you're doing is being a highly educated upper middle class person within the system, and for a brief moment creating a break in that system of acceding to rendering invisible the cost of our lifestyle. Because that is the cost of our lifestyle. It's the cost of my lifestyle. I live in a house in LA, you know, and I listen to those people and I want to, you know, give it up or something. But I mean, that's it. You know, every one of us who lives that life is living it at the cost of other people. And it's particularly, it is much more striking in the United States because we've acceded to it. We've acceded to a system where there's tremendous inequity. And, I mean, really, we don't feel empowered to be politicians. It's like it's a totally different feeling living in a massive country where politics feels like a different world from what we do. I think it's amazing in Europe the way sometimes intellectuals or academics or politicians, it's inconceivable. I mean, at least Obama read Fanon, you know, which I take as a huge triumph, but that's the best we can do. I mean, it doesn't feel like there's any inroads for us to be directly active as politicians. So what we can do is this kind of, you know, critical ethnography, and as much as we can to break down that system where
I can't believe that, if you really think that you can't do more than this. Although it's
Yeah, Karen. No, other Karen. Yes.
I'd like to say a few things about the film. Was very moving and really exciting. I could imagine working with this piece of work that you've produced with my students, and it would be really opening, it's potentially opening up great conversations across divides between students in my classroom, because I have middle class students and I have very poor students in the same classroom, and the poor students won't talk about it usually, which is okay, but there's a wealth of information that often doesn't get exchanged due to that reticence and difficulty of talking about the painful experience of being that poor in the United States. And I have students who I know sleep in cars, and I have students who have to come huge distances in order to get to the university. They don't have money to park. You know, I know there are single parents. You know, I know there's a lot going on, but we can't. It's hard for them to talk about it. They can't come to office. You know, it's so. I think that there's a whole dimension here, even if they're not in. It's quite that the extreme situation. The people that you're portraying here they probably know somebody who's like that. So I think it's very exciting, and it gives us this kind of, I don't think this is just ethnography. I think this is art, and I think it's political art. That's what I would call it. I don't know, we have to get into labels. But I find it's very exciting and very helpful and heartbreaking, and makes me want to do something with it. And I would just say, finally, that to me, the term intellectual can be very empty. I think you can be a fascist intellectual, you can be a conservative intellectual, you can be a progressive intellectual. I think being a teacher is, I rail against it, I'm sick of it, I'm tired, but it's really good work, and that we have the opportunity to reach a lot of people and make a lot of change, those of us who spend a lot of time in classrooms. And it's wonderful to have tools and pieces like this that help us do that job. So I wanted to thank you for that.
So we have just a couple minutes left on this session. What I'd like to do is have comments that directly speak to what Natalie just presented, and then we're going to move into another session where we can talk more generally about the issues raised by the conference. Somebody, yeah, go for it.
Okay, keeping that in mind, and yes, my question is definitely geared towards you, but also just addressing some of the topics that were raised, and I'm going to try to make this brief and being very conscious here. I feel like we are negating the agency that is involved when we raise issues about looking at people in poverty. I feel like in terms of your comment, in terms of like, oh, well, we're kind of gathered here, and what are we doing for them? And I think, and this goes directly back to what we just saw them say that they don't want to be viewed in that way, and yet now we're creating this very sympathetic, and it should be sympathetic, but no, it shouldn't be sympathetic, it should be empathetic. And we're kind of gazing down upon them in a way that removes their agency, removes their subjectivity in that. And I say this as someone, and not to become make this anecdotal, but as someone who worked her way in that terrible response out of that environment to this room that we're talking about. And I think that we're, by doing so, by looking at them in that very sympathetic manner, we're also negating the undercommons that exist within institutions and the people who do rally together to actually make social change. And that those people, as evident with a woman who had two BA degrees and wants to get a PhD, like, they exist within this environment. It's not just completely outside of the institution. It's actually integrated now. And especially with the way that student debt works, it's even more integrated. So it's not something that's completely separate from you, and it shouldn't be an issue of, should people in poverty learn to talk more about them? Like, how do we turn the mic on them in your class? And I'm sorry, I'm railing against what you just said, because I find that very offensive of, oh, I know some of my students sleep in their cars. How do I get them to talk about what it's like for them to sleep in cars? That totally makes them into an object. And I'm not sure that's exactly what you meant, but I'm just kind of picking apart what you said.
Can I respond and to what you just said?
I think Natalie gets to respond.
Absolutely.
Because I haven't for a while, just because I kind of want to hear what people say. I have a lot to say to everybody.
Right, and this is
but maybe afterwards, because I really wanted to hear your comments. But I chose 9 frames because of the Supreme Court 9 judges. So I wanted them to be sitting in, I mean, and they're all looking. A lot of times people aren't talking, but they're looking. And they're looking at themselves, but they're also, I've sort of said, imagine this is who you're talking to. This is your audience. So there is a direct address that I set that up because I wanted it to be kind of to put people on equal planes, that we're not above anybody or below anybody, but we're looking at each other and there's some kind of initiation of a conversation. And I often have gotten, as I've been showing in the last year or so that I've been showing little clips of work in progress, people will say, well, that's not what people who are sometimes homeless or really poor look like. You know, did they dress up for this? Where, in fact, so many people in America are living in poverty and are ashamed of it and are hiding it and are in, you know, sort of at UC Davis or Riverside or wherever. I mean, but, you know, it's not what we imagine. It's not an other. I mean, this is what I was trying to do, is to say this is us. This is not them. You know, and that it's something that has to be addressed in that way.
Absolutely. And that was actually what I was gearing towards in terms of the examples that you chose. And I think that what I got from it and what I think that is very effective is that it kind of renegotiates what we think of when we think of poverty. And so I was actually going to ask about the frames, but you just answered it. So
that's also about looking. Right. I mean, a lot of it is about looking. I mean, there's so much language, and I'm struggling with sort of how much or how much to take out and how much to keep just the look in, because I think the words can be too much. But
thank you. Anyway.
Okay. I'm going to be a terrible person now and move us on to the next session. But it's good because there are lots of people who want to talk. This next session is all about talking. So, well, this is what we're going to do. We're going to get into small groups. I've asked Nick and I both asked everybody who has spoken at the, not people who've spoken from the audience, but people who've spoken up here, to sort of mix in with the audience. I'd like us to get into groups of maybe 4 or 5 people maximum. I think that's good, Nick. 6 maybe. And you need to answer one. We're going to give you about 15 minutes. You need to answer one question, which you will report back to the group, which is, I like to think of it as the ultra-red question. What did you hear? Not what did you say, not what did you think, what did you hear? And so we're going to sort of recapitulate the discussions we've been having over the last couple days. We'll break up, we'll talk for 15 minutes, then we'll listen, then we'll discuss. I will take notes. They will be behind me on the screen. So, each group.